Hi guys, Susan here with a quick announcement for the episode today. Looks like we chose a bad time to do a two-parter on Russia because since we recorded this episode earlier in the week, kind of a lot has gone down in the world of the Trump administration. But for now, enjoy part two of our update on all things Trump and Russia, and we'll be back next week to see just how much farther Mueller's investigation has gotten.
There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back, listeners of the 45th. We are going to start our second part of the Russia deep dive, and I'm excited to welcome back our very special guest, John Cryer. John, how are you?
I'm great. Great. Can't wait to get started. Still holding my urine.
Wow. Like days later. How long has it been? It's been a few days.
This is highly anticipated.
Yes. It turns out that my estimate of one episode for the Russia contacts was grossly underestimating the amount of time it would take to get through the many, many contacts. But where we left off was in roughly about April with Papadopoulos arriving.
April 2016.
Yes. He arrived at the meeting in Washington, D.C. at the unfinished D.C. hotel that is now the sort of the hub of D.C. corruption. And interestingly, just a mild trivia fact for you, Trump's campaign expenses include like the salaries for the D.C. hotel managers.
Fascinating.
Yeah, which I guess is because they had to open up the unfinished hotel so they could have this national security meeting there. And yeah, so we don't know quite exactly what happened between Papadopoulos and his overseas contacts, Mifsud and Timofeev. And I'm sure there's more there. But let's switch back a bit to a little bit before this meeting in D.C., before the national security meeting, which was March 31st, there was a speech given. It was Trump's sort of time to shine and to prove he was a real foreign policy expert and he had the chops to be president. So he gives a speech at the Mayflower Hotel and mostly stays on message. I think it was notable at the time because it was one of the few occasions which Trump actually followed a script, more or less. And at this meeting, we're waiting details, but this is one of the times that Jeff Sessions met with Russian Ambassador Kislyak and did not disclose it on several occasions, both in his like security disclosures and in his testimony for his confirmation hearing for Attorney General.
Yeah, supposedly this was such a minor interaction that he didn't even remember it.
Yeah, we don't have any evidence of any serious discussions taking place here, except for the fact that there have been anonymous sources in various articles in the months since that reference Kislyak making calls home to Russia and talking about substantive discussions that he had with Jeff Sessions.
I didn't see any of those. I missed that.
Again, it's anonymous sources, people who, we don't know who they are. They're possibly intelligence people, possibly White House sources. And we don't know exactly what the nature of Kislyak's reports back were. But the reports did state that they believed Kislyak. They don't think this was like a disinfo thing. They don't think he was trying to set up Sessions by knowing he was getting intercepted. But at the same time, how the hell do we know that? It is very possible, too, the Russians were interested in kneecapping Trump by making these conversations public at a time that hurt Sessions. Mm.
One thing I also wanted to point out about Jeff Sessions was he claims that in that March 31st meeting at the unfinished Washington Hotel, that he shut down the idea of any Russia contacts with George Papadopoulos at the time. But if that's so, it's certainly odd that both Carter Page and Papadopoulos so aggressively pursued all these Russia contacts afterwards. If he publicly in a meeting, in their big national security meeting where they tweeted photos of it and he supposedly shut down the idea of meeting Russia, just keep that in mind as we go through the myriad of contacts that these guys continued to have.
Was that about Papadopoulos or was that about Carter Page?
That was Papadopoulos. Carter Page was busy at this meeting overseas with the top U.S. military personnel.
Yes, but Papadopoulos continued it as aggressively as Carter Page did. And it's interesting that nobody got word to Carter Page, hey, you know, we shouldn't do this because Jeff mentioned that it's probably not a good idea.
Bad idea.
Now.
On the other hand, I fully believe that there were competing factions within the Trump campaign that the left hand didn't always know what the right hand was doing. And it is possible that Jeff Sessions was not personally totally on board with this plan, but others were. I don't think that's possible at all. I mean, I think he definitely knew what was going on and maybe not approving of it. But we know, for instance, that the campaign co-chair, Sam Clovis, wrote back to Papadopoulos and said, like, great work, in response to his email outlining a possible meeting with Putin.
But there is also the possibility that if there were competing factions, that there might have been a limit to how much Jeff Sessions knew about what was going on. Like, for example, if they had come to some kind of agreement with Russians to hack stuff and to, you know, do the trolling online and to, like, just saturate social media with crazy messaging from Russia, then maybe that's stuff that Sessions, they just said, you know, we're not going to tell him because he's not fully on board.
Yeah. Or he lied.
Or
that's
he lied.
Possible. Well, I'm just throwing
I think
that
he
out,
definitely,
guys.
It could be that in his head, he's like, I was against the plan, so I'm okay lying and saying I knew nothing about it.
Sure.
Was he in the running at that time for attorney general? I mean, there was
he knew he was getting something. I'm sure he, yeah. Right.
So yeah, he was the first guy who came out and
the first.
Endorsed him, yep.
Yeah. Moving on to April 2016. At this point, it looks, I mean, it's pretty clear that, you know, barring some miracle, Trump is going to be the nominee. And there's still talk about, you know, trying to manage the convention so he doesn't become the nominee, but that's kind of a fantasy from the start. And again, the contacts between Team Trump and Team Putin continue. For Papadopoulos, we've already been over this in earlier episodes, but he's still emailing his contacts, Putin's niece, quote unquote, and the professor. And again, it's always talk about having a meeting, setting up a meeting, setting up conversations. And this is after the point where he has been told by the professor that they have dirt on Hillary. They're not directly referenced in the emails we've seen so far, but, well, like we discussed last week, it's basically impossible that didn't come up after his trip to London. But let's go back to Paul Manafort. Now, Paul Manafort, well, he has a lot of Russian contacts, a lot of oligarch contacts, and the most important one is a guy named Oleg Deripaska, who he was in contact with during the election. And we don't know, again, exactly why Deripaska wanted to be involved, other than the fact he has a big contact in the presidential campaign, so why not? But Paul Manafort had a long-term business partner, a Ukrainian-Russian named Konstantin Kilimnik, who he emailed several times throughout the campaign and met with apparently twice, at least once, but apparently twice, once in April and then later on, which we'll get into, in August. And Paul Manafort wrote to him and said, hey, have you seen all the good coverage I've gotten for representing Trump? You should tell our friends in Russia, quote, I mean, that's what he's implying, about how good this is for me. And Kilimnik writes back to tell him, yeah, I've been forwarding every article to our friends in Russia. They use code names like OBD, which is Oleg Deripaska's initials. And Kilimnik's like, this is great. It will hugely enhance your reputation no matter what happens. And
angry bastard, sorry.
Yeah. And the concern is from Paul Manafort is, quote, how do we use to get whole? And I don't know how they're going to use this to get whole, but they were clearly looking to monetize their contacts between Trump and the contacts with Russia. And again, on April 12th is when we have an attempt by the person who later does DCLeaks.com to register a website called electionleaks.com. They don't succeed. They mess up the registration somehow. It doesn't happen. But then a week later, they come back and register DC Leaks, which will be used throughout the election to occasionally drop leaked materials.
Do you know if that's registered with the U.S.?
No, I think it was Romanian.
Okay.
But April 19th is when we have Ted Cruz mathematically eliminated from seizing the majority delegates outright. So at this point, it's either Trump or a, you know, broker convention. And again, throughout this time, we still have the Russian Internet Research Agency is posting Facebook ads, social media ads, and designed to sort of like cause tensions and promote Trump and hurt Hillary. There's some examples on the chart you might want to check out as well. So in May, very early on, both Cruz and the other remainder, Kasich, suspend their campaigns, which means it's Trump only. Trump is heading towards convention to be nominated and will be facing Hillary in the general. And this is when we have Carter Page start appearing more. He is in contact pretty regularly, it seems, with a guy named Waleed Faris, who is also a foreign policy advisor, J.D. Gordon, who during the campaign kind of slid under the radar, but I think now it's pretty clear, knows a lot about what happened. It's going to be a pretty key focus for Mueller's investigation. And also some other names that you don't hear very often, like Tara Dahl and a few other people.
Who is J.D. Gordon? Can you explain that?
He's just another advisor. He's another advisor.
All right. Okay.
Was J.D. Gordon at the big meeting that Jeff Sessions presided over?
Yes, he was one of the people who has spoken openly, and he's the one actually who dubbed in Sessions and said, nope, Sessions pushed back against the suggestion from Papadopoulos. So the most recent Russian meeting that's been revealed is the NRA convention. We kind of had hints about this for a long time now. I think actually maybe even back in July of 2017 is when news first was released that there was some West Virginian who was suggesting a meeting between Trump and Russians. And then it kind of went away for a bit, and we didn't know what the hell it was about, other than it was some sort of like Christian connection. Again, this is a push from Russia to be like, hey, Republican groups in the U.S., we're white and Christian and love guns too. Come be with us.
Putin is so Christian.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
He's absolutely a model Christian.
I know.
The same way Trump is.
You guys know as well as me that when it comes to the holidays, well, it's mostly all about food. So we're going to stop for just a moment to talk about this most vital part of the holidays. And whether you're planning a big dinner party for family or friends, or you just want to whip up a seasonal dish here and there, well, the chances are you're going to need some guidance and inspiration in the kitchen, because you can't keep doing the same old stuff over and over again. And that's where Bon Appetit magazine comes in. It's packed with recipes, trends, and other food intel from around the globe. Bon Appetit is not only an indispensable source for cooks at all levels, it's also the perfect gift for people who love food, and, well, who doesn't love food? Right now, Bon Appetit is offering an exclusive for podcast listeners, which is great news because if you're like me, you probably still have some gift shopping to do. And here's the best part. The regular price is just $15 for a year, but for a limited time, you're going to save $5 off of that too. And you're going to get a one-year subscription plus an exclusive Bon Appetit tote bag at just $10 for an entire year's subscription. It's not only a great gift for others, it's also something you can give yourself too. And if you have a sweet tooth or know a chocolate lover, well, check out the Bon Appetit box offer. You'll get a one-year subscription plus a special Bon Appetit gift box packed with goodies like Guitar chocolate, which is great stuff. It's just delicious if you ever tried it. An exclusive chocolate chip toffee recipe from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, a Jacques Pepin spatula, and that cool tote we mentioned earlier. All you gotta do is use promo code for a special discount and start shopping now at bonappetit.com/getBA. Once again, don't miss out on this special offer. $10 for an entire year subscription for anybody out there in your life who loves food, including you. There's still time to get these gifts in, so start shopping now at bonappetit.com/getBA and use promo code 45 for a special discount.
But what we know now is that in May, this guy named Rick Clay, who was kind of a nobody, so don't worry about him, emailed Rick Dearborn he's a Trump campaign person again. And what we know now of his email is that it says that, hey, the NRA convention is going to be in St. Louis. Trump's scheduled to be there and give a speech. I'm hosting a dinner that same day for to honor wounded veterans. So I hope Trump can attend. By the way, it'd be a good chance for Trump to meet Alexander Torshin, who we discussed last week. Again, another Russian oligarch who is a big NRA dude. And it had phrases such as, like, the Russians believe they had shared Christian values with the Trump campaign they wanted to discuss. And according to one source, and I have not seen this in all the papers, so I don't know if this is confirmed, but there is a suggestion that the email actually said or suggested that Torshin might be carrying a message from Putin himself. Now, I guess that the big part of this email is its subject line, which was Russian backdoor overture and dinner invite. I can't say that phrase without giggling.
Well, but again, if these people feel like they're doing something nefarious, it is odd that they're doing it in such a dumb sort of outwardly. It just feels like they'd be better at it if they were doing something completely nefarious.
That's the thing with conspiracies. They're usually less organized and stupider than you expect.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, the subject line, really, it could have been like cute cat videos or something else. The subject is like Russia collusion and let's break the law. I mean, it's kind of crazy.
Well, but the thing is, if this was a movie, you would say, no, can we have something more believable there? I don't buy it. So that's I think that's where my instinct for that comes from.
Well, apparently Jared Kushner has similar instincts to you, because although he spun it through his attorneys as like, oh, look, Jared Kushner was against this meeting. He was a good guy who didn't want to do something sketchy. If you look at his response, the one he claims shows him rejecting the meeting, it reads a little bit differently. He wrote, pass on this. A lot of people come claiming to carry messages. Very few who were able to verify. For now, I think we decline such meetings. Most likely, these people then go back home and claim they have special access to gain importance for themselves. Be careful.
Ooh, he's a little slightly smarter than I thought.
Yeah, so he's rejecting it, but not because he doesn't want to meet with Russia. He rejects it because he thinks the guy is not high enough in Russia.
Or not legit, right?
Yeah, and that's possible. But also keep in mind, a lot of people come claiming to carry messages. Who are these a lot of people? Jared Kushner has knowledge of other contacts at this point. I mean, he might claim that these other contacts were other countries and not Russian contacts, but I wouldn't buy that. But even if Kushner shut this down, doesn't look like everyone in the campaign did, because at the NRA convention that happens in late May, May 20th, Torshin does meet, not with Kushner, with Donald Jr. Now, there's been a whole lot of different stories about what this meeting entailed, what it involved, what exactly went down. But eventually, Donald Jr. did concede that he didn't sit with Torshin, but he talked to him at the meeting.
Yeah, once again, sharing a dinner table at that kind of event, that's not by accident. Like you said earlier, John, these things are highly planned.
And Torshin's the same guy who met with Trump at the 2015 NRA convention. Torshin, again, is also pretty close with the sort of the head muckety-mucks in the NRA. And he tweets all the time. Or he used to tweet all the time. He blocked me on Twitter, so I can't read it anymore. But he did have a lot of he did have a lot of tweets about how he was like suggesting he was known Trump for 5 years, or how his aide Maria Butina like was getting updates from Trump about how he was really interested in a pro-Russian relationship.
Now, didn't Don Jr. claim that they didn't actually sit next to each other, or I think he may have claimed that they met in passing again?
They said all kinds of things. So, like at one point, they were saying that like there was a separate dinner somewhere that they were also attended and that maybe they saw each other. One time the White House claimed that they went to a restaurant and just happened to run into Torshin and said greetings and that's it. At one point it was called a private dinner, but it looks like, from what we could tell, it looks like most likely there's a sort of an auction dinner at 6 o'clock on the 20th. That seems to be where they were in the same room together. Then again, it could just be trying to cover up the fact that there was in fact a second dinner where they actually were seated together, maybe on the following night. The day after this possible meeting, or this definite meeting at some point between Torshin and Don Jr., Papadopoulos gets back in the mix, and he sends an email to Paul Manafort. And the subject is request from Russia to meet Mr. Trump. And this is the time where Paul Manafort responds to his partner, Rick Gates, and says, we need someone to communicate that DT, Donald Trump, is not doing these trips. It should be someone low level in the campaign so as not to send any signal. Again, this is something that Manafort's tried to spin as showing he rejected the meetings, but the full context shows no, it wasn't a rejection. They are just trying to be cautious about it.
Or is it suggesting that the person to communicate should be someone low level?
Yeah. It should be someone like Carter Page himself.
Yeah, that's English can be parsed in many, many ways.
Yeah, and Manafort's right. You can't have Trump meeting with...
Yeah.
So the little underlings were overenthusiastic and not very bright and not very sophisticated. Manafort's played this game for a while and he knows what he's doing. And he was not going to let Trump go in person to Russia to talk to Putin one-on-one. But 5 days later, we have Carter Page sending an email, this time to J.D. Gordon and Bernadette Kilroy, another person on the campaign team you don't hear much about. And he says, I'm planning to speak alongside the chairman and CEO of Sberbank, as we'll be both giving commencement addresses at Moscow's New Economic School on July 8th. So as of May 26th, this plan for Carter Page to go visit Russia is already in place, and the campaign knows about it. And there's no indication that there's ever pushback.
And what on earth does a student who's going to the New Economic School in Moscow want to have any desire to have Carter Page speak at their commencement? They're like, woo, Carter Page. He's going to give me some exciting thoughts.
Yes.
To go forward in my life.
I mean, it's bizarre.
I do not understand that. Yes.
But the point is, like, he's played this off as like a private thing. He wanted to go live his life during the campaign. That's a quote from him, by the way. But again, this is so basically, like, right after we have all these emails discussing possibly having a low-level person go meet with Russia, Carter Page has a trip to Russia to go talk to Vietnam people. And so later on in June, we have, again, Carter Page was giving a speech for Prime Minister Modi, Indian Prime Minister, who was in the Washington, D.C., and he... Carter Page kind of shocks everyone in the room by giving this like anti-US speech. Everyone's like, wow, that's weird. What also happens in June, though, is, of course, a pretty sort of lately been a pretty big deal, or described as a big deal, and that is the June 9th meeting. The one with Rob Goldstein setting it up with the Agalarovs and these Russian people who claim they were there to discuss adoptions. Now, I think, and we're going to not spend too much time on this because it's a pretty complicated issue on its own, and especially the cover-up, which I think is going to end up being a bigger deal than the meeting itself is. But what we know is that Rob Goldstone emails his old buddy, Don Jr., is like, I got people in Russia who want to talk to you. And that first email is, what it describes is something pretty significant. Goldstone writes, Imman just called and asked me to contact you with something interesting. The Crown Prosecutor of Russia met with his father, Aris, this morning, and in their meeting offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. This is obviously very high-level and sensitive information, but it is part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump, helped along by Aris and Imman. What do you think the best way to handle this information is, and would you be able to speak to Imman about it directly? I can also send this info to your father via Rona, but it is ultra-sensitive, so wanted to send to you first. Now, as we all know, Don Jr. responds with, that is very bizarre, and I can't imagine why Russia would help us. Please, no thank you. Yeah, no. He says, no, I love it. And I think this meeting was ultimately a bust. I think it was Russia feeling out the Trump campaign. I don't think anything highly significant happened at the meeting itself. But these emails show what was going on. First of all, they believe it's the Russian government. The Crown Prosecutor is not a position that really exists in Russia, but the equivalent person is a high-level Russian legal official who seems to have been involved with Aris Akhlerov. And again, Akhlerov is like a billionaire and an oligarch and not like a dupe. He knew what he was doing, and he wouldn't have been taken in by something that was totally a fraud, as they're now suggesting. But another thing that I found significant was that in Goldstone's email, he says, I can send this to your father via Rona, but it's ultra-sensitive, so I want to go to you first. Now, Rona is the long-term secretary, Rona Gaff, long-term secretary of Trump. And Trump doesn't use email, but he does use Rona, which I think that, again, this means that they were considering looping Trump into this stuff, but they know that because of his lack of email, like, it's hard to get to him directly, so he thought I'll say, Rob Goldstone thought it was safer to go to Don Jr. instead. And the response from Don Jr. again shows that, yes, he's totally okay with any kind of, like, dirt from Russia coming in.
I love that Goldstone is, like, doing check-ins. He's like planning these things.
Oh yes, on Facebook he did check in to show that he was there. Yeah,
preparing for meeting. Unbelievable.
But again, in a movie you wouldn't buy it. You would say these guys are too dumb to be this evil. But you know,
do you think they just didn't realize how wrong, I mean, who leaves such a, that they really didn't understand, like, the legal issues or ethical issues around this? They just thought this is, like, how this stuff works, and it's normal contacts with foreign governments during a campaign. He's the front runner. I mean, I wonder how much of it is just, like, ignorance of the law type of thing.
Well, I mean, I'm sure they can chalk up a lot of it to a very disorganized campaign being run by people who don't normally do this. You know, I mean, Trump was not a career politician, obviously. You know, a lot of this felt thrown together as it was happening. You always kind of assume, oh, the RNC is in charge of this, or the DNC is in charge of this. But I think to some degree, you know, this was an outlier, because I think a lot of people, you know, I don't know how many people in the Republican establishment really supported Trump becoming the nominee. And so, you know,
I think he was just so paranoid about who was in his close inner circle. So you don't have anybody there who are, like, actual foreign policy experts, actual national security experts, actual experts on any, like, legal issues. It's just kind of, like you said, this is a bunch of random guys who do business with Russia and with these weird contacts.
And this goes back to sort of discussion, like, what the motives and means were, both Russia and Team Trump. Because it definitely is not a clear case of, like, Russia just wants Trump to win and they're doing what they can to help him. They're not on Trump's side. I mean, Trump winning helps them, but they aren't helping Trump. Like, where hurting Trump helps them, they try and hurt him. And so, like, we kind of, like, whatever happened, whoever won the primary, Russia would have tried to interfere. They would have tried to have emails hacked. They would have tried to damage Hillary, most likely with the goal of assuming Hillary would get elected so they could really undercut her presidency before it even starts by putting all these scandals out there. And you can see the Uranium One stuff, that bogus, fake conspiracy theory they're putting out there. even in 2015, they were trying to push that. It just didn't get any traction for a long time because it's so bizarre. But from the Trump side, it looks like the motives are pretty simple. Like, their first motive was to get dirt on Hillary. They are totally convinced that Russia has these emails. They want these emails. And they'll do what it takes to get them. They also want to make sure it doesn't, like, get too obvious. But they're not experienced at this and not great at this whole game of, like, espionage. So they do take stupid risks and do stupid communications with really obvious email headers. But their other goal was financial. In addition to this sort of, like, this bigger, like, shared goal of getting dirt on Hillary to win an election, a lot of them have very individual financial motivations for the actions they're taking. Let's take Flynn. Flynn not only had the RT gala, which is what, like, $45,000 for a speech, but he also has this big power plant deal in Saudi Arabia that involves, like, sort of Russian cooperation, which I think is going to be a huge point of the case against him. And he had a very serious financial motivation there for what he was doing. We also have Kushner. Kushner has his, like, failing 666 building in New York, and we know a lot of his outreach, at least after the election, was aimed at finding financing for that building. And then we have Manafort. Manafort's financial motivation is clear here. He outright states, how do we use this to get whole? And of course, we have Trump's organization, and Trump himself, and they've got the building, the Trump Tower in Moscow they're looking at, which comes up again both in 2015 and 2016, and they thought they'd make lots of money from it. So in each of these interactions from their side, it seems like they are, like, yes, always with the goal of getting this dirt, but pursuing individual motivations as well, which means they're not operating the same team all the time. And I think it looks like we have, like, possibly several different outreaches from the Trump campaign trying to get dirt on Hillary. Like, Flynn's got his little thing with Peter W. Smith. Manafort's working Deripaska. Papadopoulos is working the professor. And Carter Page is doing God knows what over in Moscow. And on the other hand, we have kind of a similar work going from the Russian side, where a bunch of different Russian operatives are reaching out towards the Trump campaign. I mean, you've got two different hacker groups in the DNC, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear. Both similar goals, it looks like, but they're not the same. It doesn't look like they're the same agency. And then we have all these random oligarchs with their own separate connections to people in Trump's orbit reaching out to the people they know to try and get contacts. So it's sort of like this mutual merging from both sides, like tendrils coming out from Russia, tendrils from Trump, connecting and trying to share information. And so from neither side is it a fully cohesive, planned effort. It's sort of organic in that sense. And there's also the timing of it. Like, they don't, for one, they have to make sure that what they're doing isn't going to come back. Russia has to be sure what they're doing isn't going to come back and hurt them. So I think that explains a lot of the chaos we're seeing, a lot of the random fits and stops and starts, is that there was no sort of, like, mastermind effort from Putin. It was just a bunch of his operatives knowing what Putin wanted, a bunch of Trump's operatives knowing what Trump wanted. They have a mutual end that they want to get to, and they go for it.
I don't know if that makes me feel slightly better, that it wasn't like an evil master plan. But in a way, yeah, I mean, like, I don't, it does reduce kind of, I mean, for me, like, I also wonder, I mean, like, I feel like even with Trump, he's so vague about things. I don't think he ever really fully thought out, like, what this could look like. I think for him, it was just like, help me win, you know, if I can win an election like this and Putin likes me. I mean, at the end of the day, he just wants, like, powerful people to like him. I feel like that was literally his agenda, and that was it. I don't think he thought any deeper about any of this stuff.
He's a deal maker. He just says, here's the deal we want, go make it. I'm sure Trump didn't know details because he didn't want it. He didn't care. It's not that he wanted to be separate from it. He wanted that dirt in Hillary. He wanted those 33,000 emails, and he'd get it by whatever it took. And he already likes Russia. He already likes Putin. So, like, it's not for him. It's like, whatever, low cost. I could be nice to Putin in exchange for getting stuff to harm my opponent. To him, it's a great deal. Everyone, it's a win-win-win. So again, there are low-level contacts going on, and they can dismiss them as being kind of low-level because they were, and they weren't part of the master plan at all. That doesn't mean they're not significant. Like the Carter Page stuff, they've distanced themselves a lot and said that, like, Carter Page is not part of the campaign. He was an unpaid informal advisor. But that July 7th trip to Moscow, the idea it wasn't part of the campaign is totally destroyed by the emails we already have. For instance, in mid-May, Carter Page wrote an email to Well Affairs and J.D. Gordon, and what had happened is that Obama gave a speech, a commencement address, and I forget his exact quote, but he said something about how in politics and in life, ignorance is not a virtue, which of course they immediately realized about Trump. Even though we never said Trump, it's kind of telling, everyone knew he meant Trump. So Carter Page wrote to them and said, Trump tweeted about this and complained about it. And Carter Page says, after seeing the Trump tweet from the cocky Obama, I've got another idea. If Trump would like to take my place and raise the temperature a bit, of course I'd be more than happy to yield this honor to him. And in his congressional testimony, Carter Page clarified that the honor was the honor of going to Russia. So, again, the campaign knows of this trip, and they know that Carter Page suggests that his place be taken by Trump as sort of a fuck you to Obama. That's not a suggestion you make if this is a private trip. Like, the idea of substituting a presidential candidate for your speech at a commencement address? Yeah, no. If that's, you don't just like pick and choose. I mean, I'm sure they would have taken Trump if he'd offered, but like, this is clearly a campaign role that Carter Page has, and he suddenly gets the gears going and thinks, it'd be really cool if Trump took my place at it. We don't know what the response to that was. They obviously decided it was a bad idea for Trump to go in person. But again, this does suggest that it was a campaign issue, even though it's from a low-level guy.
All right, so where are we now? We are in...
We're going in towards July.
Late summer, yeah, okay. Or midsummer, okay. I feel like this is when things start to get a little evil.
I mean, they were always... The malicious intent was always there, but the organization never really was. And again, going through this entire time period, we still have Carter Page in discussions with people overseas. We have Papadopoulos emailing and Skyping with Mifsud and Timofeev. We have DC Leaks releasing all kinds of stuff. And we have Trump tweeting all the time, like, crooked Hillary Clinton is guilty as hell, but the system is totally rigged and corrupt. Where are the 33,000 missing emails? But let's get back from the Republican side of things to take a look at what was going on the Democratic side. Now, so far, there haven't been really any serious leaks of the DNC stuff. There was a little bit in mid-June from the guy, the persona, Guccifer 2.0, but the really damaging stuff hasn't come out yet. In fact, sort of the big headliner stuff that's been leaked so far is the DNC's own Oppo research on Trump. So that's not even about Hillary.
Which, by the way, I don't think they did a particularly great job on their Oppo research.
No, they didn't. If you read the document, it's really basic.
Yeah. I mean, if you just – I grew up in New York. Just that, you knew more than – I mean, just living in New York, you knew what a douche this guy was.
It was all above the belt stuff. Like, they were like – not trying to get into the real scandals that are there for Trump. And that's all, like, he had bad positions in certain policy points.
Oh, God bless them. They're sweet, the Oppo research people.
But there's a big event that's going on right around now that we need to know a lot more about. First of all, in early July, Comey gives that press conference where he goes off on Hillary, like, out of procedure and sort of striking to everyone involved. I mean, the Republicans are like, look how mad he is at Hillary. Look at all the stuff he says about her. And everyone else is like, oh, this is not how the FBI and DOJ work. Why is the head of the FBI giving this kind of speech about it? This is a DOJ decision. What we know now is that there is something of a backstory here. We know that there was some kind of intercept. The Americans somehow got some intel from the Russians, including a document dump. And one of those documents was a purported leaked email. And what it seems to be from its face, what if you're reading it, what it looks like is that the former DNC head is emailing this guy involved in George Soros's Open Society Foundation, because George Soros is behind everything. And she says that a Clinton staffer named Amanda Renteria talked to Loretta Lynch, the attorney general at the time, and that Lynch assured her that she would prevent the investigation into Clinton from going too far. Now, this is would be a big deal, because this is a suggestion that the attorney general has told a candidate for president that she will not let the investigation go into her. Like, she's going to stop that investigation. She's going to take political efforts here to stop the whole email stuff. And according to Lindsey Graham, he has said that twice when he got briefings on this, Comey referenced this email as part of the story for why he went off alone on Hillary. He felt that the DOJ could not make a decision not to prosecute Hillary, that they were too politically compromised, and that if this email were to come out, it would destroy the DOJ's reputation, because it would show that they are biased and that they'd already reached a decision on the Hillary matter and privately agreed not to investigate it. So this would be a really big deal, except the email is a fake. It was Russian disinfo that was, we don't know again, we don't know how they got it, we don't know who believed it, but, and Comey himself has suggested he never believed it and it was all a lie, which could be true. But it does seem like this email affected his behavior, that he thought the risk would be that the email would get leaked. And to avoid that circumstance, he decided he would take control and himself step up and shut down the investigation rather than let the DOJ do it. So when we say that Russia interfered with the election, it's not just the way they try to sort of boost Trump and hurt Hillary. It's that they were taking actions politically designed to hurt Hillary, even separate from Trump. And I think it's very possible that, and, you know, who knows, butterfly flaps his wings in Brazil, whatever. But without that disinfo email, would Comey still have written his letter late in the election? I mean, we don't know now, but when we say that if someone says that Russia interfered with the election or they actually impacted the outcome, it's not just talking about the Facebook ads. It's not just talking about working with Trump. It's this whole barrage of acts that sort of corrupted our institutions and our reactions to them. Any more thoughts there? So it's not just me rambling.
I imagine for people in Comey's position, you're operating within a cloud of information that you don't know the veracity of. And I think we all as a nation have to get ourselves in a place where we have got to question where we get our information, because, you know, there's, you know, because we consider the internet and Facebook and social media as our means to get information, other people get that too and can figure out ways to manipulate that.
Yeah, this problem isn't going away, and Russia won't be the only person trying to use it. Going into July, we have still Manafort talking to his buddies over his business partner, Kilinick, who's talking to the people with Deripaska, and they're talking about, again, this is where the email comes, where Paul Manafort says, tell V's boss, aka Deripaska, that if he needs private briefings on the Trump campaign, we can accommodate. And there's probably two big events that happen in July related to Russia contacts. The first is the GOP platform. And again, in hindsight, when they write history books on this, they're going to say, President Trump took no action to alter the Republican platform except to water it down on Ukraine in a way Russia would like. We should have known from then. Like, that should have been the giveaway. What happened was there was language in the RNC platform and it said, like, we support giving arms to Ukraine to fight off the Russian invaders. And Trump's people were heavily involved in getting that changed to make sure it didn't happen. And that's the only change they made. Like, that's a dead giveaway right there. And in case you're questioning whether or not that was actually the Trump people, Carter Page sends an email to help us out here where he says, as for the Ukraine amendment, excellent work. So despite the denials of Trump, despite the denials of Manafort, it looks very clearly as if that was their engineering. And the other big event is the one where Trump outright tells the Russians, please give us dirt on Hillary. And in Trump's mind, if you do it publicly, it's not a scandal. And he seems to be right about that, because everyone seems to think, you know, since Trump openly announced, hey, Russia, if you're listening, release the emails on Hillary, that was just a joke and not him being deadly, earnestly serious.
And it read as absolutely serious when he said it. It was not greeted with gales of laughter. He did not have his usual sort of smirk. It was, you know, he said it several times and he said it very clearly.
Mm-hmm. And this was also the last press conference that Trump did during the election. After that, they're like, oh, no, this guy cannot be allowed to talk like that again.
Hell
but
no.
He says so many things during that press conference that are crazy. Like, he facilitates between going like, oh, Russia, please give the emails, and then saying, we don't know if it's Russia. We can't know if it's Russia. Even though his campaign was told in April.
He knows it. He knows Russia. He's just, yeah. He's gonna be the worst poker player ever. He just can't. He's like that ant in your who just can't keep it in their stomach.
Well,
it's like,
but he would be great because he'd be everything. Like, I have a tremendous hand. I have the best hand. My hand's the greatest, no matter what he had.
Well, it is fascinating to see in retrospect that it worked. You know, he gives himself deniability all the time by being just rambling. And by being rambling and incoherent and inarticulate and incorrect. That threesome is very difficult to fight against because you can always, you know, he can always say, I was joking, I was rambling, I contradicted myself another time. You know, he can always say, I said that once, but I said another thing another time. It actually provides him a remarkable amount of cover. Or it does, just because he's managed to, you know, keep his tribal base. You know, they don't care.
But even the ones, so like, not all of his base would be on board with everything he says. And this way he can appeal to the worst of them without committing to stuff that some of them actually would flinch at. And they can read into it what they want to read. But sometimes he does get specific and it gets even weirder. Like Trump said in that same press conference, Putin has said things over the last year that are really bad things, okay? He mentioned the N-word one time. I was shocked to hear him mention the N-word. You know what the N-word is, right? He mentioned it. I was shocked. He has a total lack of respect for Obama. Okay, so what the hell is going on here? Like, there's two options. There's two options here. Either in the past year, so like from July 2015 to July 2016, Trump talked to Putin and Putin used the N-word. Or Trump's making this all up and he wanted an excuse to call Obama the N-word. Mm. Like, there's really not another way to read that.
Or to somehow position himself as the better of the two. Like, you know, of course, he's been questioning his birth place for years now. But, you know, he wouldn't go that far, you know, and he was disrespectful to Obama, that Putin was disrespectful. It's amazing.
But like, no one followed up on this. No one's like, OK, we need to clarify exactly when Trump heard Putin call Obama the N-word. No one's ever asked him that. No one's tried to clarify what the hell he was talking about here. It can go either way. And I think it's possible that this is something that really did get communicated between Putin and Trump, or like they're taught, like something happened there. Or again, maybe that's just his way of calling Obama the N-word. And there's one more thing he said that, again, maybe mean meaningless, but I've always found fascinating. He says at the very end, towards the end of the press conference, I don't like Huma, that's Clinton's aide, going home at night and telling Anthony Weiner all of these secrets, okay? So how can Hillary Clinton be briefed on this unbelievably delicate information when it was just proven that she lied and their server shouldn't have had it and that they're missing 33,000 emails and that's just the beginning? So I don't think that I know at some point they're going to be calling. They're going to want to brief me, but I'm not a talker about this stuff. Okay, it's gobbledygook. But to me, it sounds like he's implying that there's something involving Anthony Weiner and Huma and 33,000 emails, and he knows something about it. And he says they're going to want to brief, like, they're going to want me to talk to him about it, but I'm not going to talk about it. Like, he's implying some kind of insider knowledge here. Again, that's just one reading of many, because his contentless sentence structure makes it hard to interpret. But he said actually said quite a few things along the campaign before the Weiner server came out.
The Weiner server.
Yeah, the Weiner server. God, our world has gotten so weird. But again, maybe that's just him rambling about nonsense. So we have, again, another Sessions meeting with Kislyak this time at the RNC convention. We've got Carter Page and another staffer meeting. And we have Carter Page and J.D. Gordon meeting with Kislyak. We have more Papadopoulos emails. Like, there's a pretty constant stream of, like, contacts going back and forth. The ones we have so far don't seem that explicit. There's not one that's been released that says, hey, do this and we'll give you the emails. But it is important to remember we do have some, actually from like February and March of this year, there were reports about how the Obama administration became concerned because they had exchanges of promises between Trump campaign people and Russia. We don't have any examples of that leaked yet, but it does seem like there are communications in which the Team Trump made promises they'd change policies in certain ways in exchange for unknown favors from Russia.
Which is collusion right there.
Yes. And yeah. That would straight up. I mean, there are a lot of criminal statutes that violate. And if that does exist, it's a matter of time. So yeah, it's the holiday season, but there's always time for gifts for yourself. And now's the time to try First Leaf. First Leaf is the only wine subscription club that's actually based on your taste. After you try and receive some of your wines, you rate them and get personalized selections. Like right now, I'm having the Astray Mars. It's got Cab Sav, Merlot, Petit Verdot, Petit Sirah. I think it's got like all the grapes in there, but it's delicious. And so have all the other wines I've had through them. So to get First Leaf, what you do is customize your first order by selecting the color, the wine regions, the frequency of wine shipments. And then you get an intro 3-pack that gets you started, and you get all three for just $5 each. Normally these wines go for about $20 each, if not more, but you get your first starter pack for $15 for three wines. When your bottles arrive, rate the wine to get personalized selections based on your unique taste. Now, to order your 3-pack for $15 plus free shipping, go to tryfirstleaf.com/45th. That's free shipping off your first order at tryfirstleaf.com/45th. Experience First Leaf today at tryfirstleaf.com/45th. So like I said earlier, there's all these sort of like side, like different competing communications between Team Russia and Team Trump. Another one of those sort of side stories involves Peter W. Smith, a long-term GOP operative. And he's the one who suggested he was working with Flynn and Conway and Bannon, and he'd been offered on the dark web Hillary's missing emails. Now, this sounds terrible and like a big deal, and I think it's a big deal they're trying to do this. I'm not sure ultimately it's going to be a big deal part of the story, because Peter W. Smith was working with some like very serious trolls. like Chuck Johnson was kind of his main contact that we know of. So, and this was an old man. He was in his 80s. So I think it's very possible that whole side story, it doesn't go anywhere because it was just some 4chan trolls who told this old guy, hey, look, we have Hillary's deleted emails. And then he spent the next 3 months on a campaign to try and find them. But it does show that there were very many people in Team Trump who wanted to find a way to get Hillary's emails. And this goes back to Rebecca Mercer and Cambridge Analytica, who also did similar stuff. In fact, we know in June, Rebecca Mercer told someone that she was concerned about trying to get the Hillary Clinton emails because of all the legal implications that would have, which shows awareness of the potential legal trouble they'd be in if they actually did what they wanted to do.
But I have to believe that they don't exist. I feel like they would have surfaced by now if they did.
There's two possibilities there. First is that they don't exist, that Russia never got them. Or possibly Russia got them and they expected Hillary to win, so they wanted to save them to use during her presidency to undermine her there. Or I guess the third possibility is they actually were all about, like, flower arrangements for Chelsea's wedding. So they,
they were
there was no point in releasing them.
Unbelievably boring.
Yeah.
Which, many of the emails that have surfaced that weren't from that batch are incredibly prosaic and boring.
I mean, most of them were. That's also the other side of this, is that those emails weren't that interesting. I am shocked at how little there was in there that was worth even making any kind of stink over. And in the end, they were so boring that they had to invent a conspiracy theory involving a pizza parlor and underage child sex trafficking to make them interesting.
Which is legit more interesting. At the studio notes, when we're making that movie, it's like, can't we go to the pizza thing with the, child molesters? Can we cut back to that? Or maybe we have a fantasy sequence. How about that?
Because the rest was just that boring. We've seen like 5 or 6 emails from the Trump campaign, and they are all 10 times more fascinating than anything we see in Clinton's emails or the Podesta emails. But let's go back to Manafort for a bit. This is also when, in late July, Kilimnik writes to Manafort, and he's now writing in serious, like, super secret agent code. That was sarcastic, by the way, to try and hide what he's discussing. But here's what he writes. I met today with a guy who gave you your biggest black caviar jar several years ago. We spent about 5 hours talking about a story, and I have several important messages from him to you. He asked me to go and brief you on our conversation. I said I have to run it by you first, but in principle I'm prepared to do it, provided that he buys me a ticket. It has to do about the future of his country, and is quite interesting.
Jeez, I am amazed that I have not heard of this before, because that is the most coded. I mean,
badly coded.
Yes, it is badly coded, but clearly, they're so trying to dance around saying something that they're not supposed to be saying. It's that's just striking.
I mean, biggest black jar of caviar is clearly like bribe money or something like that. It's clearly about Deripaska, and Paul Manafort's response is Tuesday is best.
Sure.
So yeah, they do. So we do know Kilimnik and Manafort meet. They go to like the Havana Cuban cigar bar or whatever. And they say they just talk about general stuff, no big deal. It's just a conversation about all kinds of things, nothing to do with campaign, just discuss the grandkids and all that. But that's not plausible. Like, look at this. This email says very clearly that there is a serious situation going on. Deripaska has something to do with the future of Russia that he wants to talk to Manafort about. And it has to be an in-person meeting, and it's all done in, code language. This was a big deal. Whatever it was something truly significant and involved direct collaboration between the campaign manager and one of the oligarchs in Russia.
Oh, I cannot wait for the Manafort trial at this point.
Yeah.
Oh, I cannot wait, because this is going to be the big reveal as far as I'm concerned.
I don't think there'll be a trial. It's going to be a plea. These guys know. They're screwed. It would be a fun trial. But
well, the only thing against that is that Manafort may believe he's got a pardon waiting for him. So he might be willing to bluff it out.
But he could take a guilty plea and then get a pardon, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. But again, if you get the pardon, you lose your Fifth Amendment right to not speak, which might not help Trump in the end. Mm-hmm. So we have the Manhattan Cigar Club meeting between Kilimnik and Manafort. And according to Manafort, they discuss unpaid bills and current news. And that, there was something big going on there. Unfortunately for Manafort, he doesn't last much longer. On the 15th or 14th of August, that story comes out from the New York Times about the black ledgers in Ukraine. And within 4 days, he's had to resign in disgrace. And then we get to everyone's favorite rat fucker, Roger Stone.
Oh, goodness.
That's what they're called, Rabia. It's,
it's not a vulgarity. It's just a straight up job title, rat fucker.
Yeah, that's what Peter Smith was as well.
Yes.
These are campaign operatives who are willing to do the dirty work, find the most damning information on the opponent. Is that correct?
In Roger's case, it's whatever kind of nonsense he wants to get up into. But he doesn't keep his mouth shut ever, which is a liability for him. Because on August 21st, he tweets out, he actually tweets, "Just trust me, it will soon the Podesta's time in the barrel." He doesn't say which B? Podesta. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess the brother is what he means, but the grammar's atrocious. Again, Podesta is the campaign manager for Hillary, and his brother is a lobbyist who actually has worked with Manafort in the past on some of the Ukraine stuff. And this becomes a problem for Roger Stone because in October, Podesta's emails are leaked. And this tweet seems to suggest he had knowledge of that event in advance. At his testimony before Congress, he says that he was actually talking about Manafort and how he knew that Manafort had troubles, but Podesta did too, and he wasn't referencing any kind of leaked emails. Maybe he's right. Maybe that's how it happened, and it's just really bad luck on his part. But I'm not buying it because we know now that Roger Stone had lots of contacts with both Guccifer 2.0 and Assange, or WikiLeaks at least, in the lead up to this tweet.
What were his contacts with Assange?
Well, he's never really clarified exactly what they were, but he does give a speech at one point where he says, "I've been in contact with Assange," and he says more stuff is coming. And he also had Twitter DMs with the Guccifer 2.0 persona, because now our political scandals involve Twitter DMs. God help us all.
Again, I think it's wrong that WikiLeaks should ever be DMing anybody, because they're supposedly about radical transparency. Put it all out there, people.
Yeah, and this is a much more complicated topic. You probably need a book to address it, not a podcast. But it's very interesting to look at sort of the ecosystem of leaks going on throughout 2016. We always talk about WikiLeaks, but WikiLeaks is not the only leaker. We've got the Guccifer 2.0 persona, and we have DCLeaks.com, all of which release their own sort of sometimes overlapping sets of documents.
Think they were in concert?
I think that there are Russian interests behind each of them, but it's pretty confusing to figure out who, what the motivations were here. I mean, they're trying to spread disinformation, trying to make it as confusing as possible to tell it apart. But I think there's one leak in particular that's been kind of overlooked, and that's the August 12th leak from DCLeaks.com. That's the only time that sort of Republican emails were leaked during the election. And it was a very small selection of mostly innocuous emails from 300 different messages sent. But they included emails, for instance, from John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who were outspoken against Trump. And they also included emails hacked from Peter W. Smith. Now, I think that's a clue that these emails from the 300 Republican emails, they were kind of targeted messages. Why else would you have leaked Peter W. Smith's emails unless you knew he was somehow involved in this process? I think it was a warning. I think it was an in-joke or something. I mean, the emails they leaked were very innocuous. They weren't really big deals or whatever. But the selection of those to include in the August 12th leak tells me that there's a bigger message behind it.
Well, they're letting them know, we've got your stuff.
Mm-hmm. And if that is the case, I think there needs to be a lot more scrutiny of those 300 emails, because some of them are really random. They involve private people that have no connection that I can see to anything important. But what if they're coded messages to people involved? What if they have dirt on certain people and that release was sort of a reminder? By the way, you keep doing this. Look what else we might know. Or they just pulled a bunch of random emails out and put them on the web for no reason.
I can't imagine that they would do it so randomly. And I also, when this all kind of came to light, I wondered, it's not just Hillary. These folks can have, troves of emails and communications on all kinds of people. Journalists were getting hacked at the time. Do you remember there was a lot of journalists were reporting that they were having issues. And I'm guessing other legislators, all kinds of people are.
They didn't just attack Hillary or the DNC. They attacked all kinds of people. We know from these leaks that Lindsey Graham and McCain are among the ones that they attacked. Yes. If you get a chance, they're worth going looking at these emails just to see how extremely random they are. And I'm wondering if any reporters out there have interviewed some of the private people who are discussing them, because I think there's better than even chance they had something important on someone they know. And then throughout August, again, kind of a slower month for leaks. WikiLeaks doesn't release anything. The first big WikiLeaks leak was in July 22nd. But DC Leaks does release stuff on the Republicans and also some Soros Open Foundation emails, because the Soros conspiracy theory apparently infects Russia too. And we have another meeting discussed between Sam Clovis and Papadopoulos. And Clovis tells Papadopoulos, I would encourage you and Waleed Faris to make the trip to talk to Russia if it's feasible. So throughout this time, there are still discussions of going to talk to Russia. And then moving to September, we have another Carter Page trip that we still don't know much about, but that's his trip to Hungary. This one's bizarre. All we know is that for some reason, he decided over Labor Day weekend to make a trip to Budapest to discuss thermal energy and meet some people. But he doesn't know who he met with, really, and he didn't actually discuss thermal energy. Like, he just kind of went to Budapest with an idea. I'm going to talk to people about thermal energy. And then
at the airport, I'll just get off the plane. And
He did talk to some government officials there, and they all say thermal energy never came up, and they weren't sure why he was there. Apparently, he showed up in tennis shoes to the meetings. And they were kind of like, one of the sources said, I'm quite disappointed that this man is really one of the Trump's foreign policy, but sorry. I'm quite disappointed if this man is really one of Trump's foreign policy advisors. But the interesting part of that whole trip is when Schiff asked Page at the hearing, so while you're in Budapest, did you happen to talk to any Russians? And Page says, not that I can recall. There may, again, similar to, we went to there was a hotel and we had coffee at a hotel and there were a few people passing through. There may have been one Russian person passing through there, but I have no recollection. But I have no recollection because it was totally immaterial and nothing serious was discussed.
That's a great answer.
Yeah. So again, I think that's a decent chance that it's going to come out before too long that, yeah, there was a Russian that he happened to pass through and talk to Carter Page while in Budapest.
Yes. Whenever they're fudging their can't recalls, it ends up showing up later that they had a reason.
But he can't recall because he does recall that if it did happen, it was totally innocuous. And that's why I can't recall.
Yes.
In September, we still have DC Leaks doing its thing. It's got like some Colin Powell emails it released. And then WikiLeaks also releases some kind of bullshit, no biggie emails from DNC. But what's kind of a big deal is October 7th, the U.S. government comes out and says, Russia was behind this. They're the ones doing it. Which is a big deal at the time. And unfortunately, they didn't go farther and say, and they're trying to help Trump because McConnell put a stop to that.
Yes, at the time, didn't the president try to approach the Republicans to put out some sort of a group statement so that it didn't seem to be particularly biased towards one side in the election?
Yeah, McConnell said, like, no, if you try and do any of this, we're going to claim you're politicizing it. You're trying to, like, you know, hijack the election. So in the end, Obama did very little to directly sort of counteract the sort of propaganda that was happening. Then we go, so later on October, we have... This is after WikiLeaks and Don Jr. start talking, but again, I think it's probably not going to be a big deal. I think it's another example of just WikiLeaks and Russian actors in general trying to like get more contacts, get their tendrils into the Trump campaign. Because again, they think probably Trump is going to lose. But if he does win, they're not on his side. And having leverage over the Trump administration would be great if it happened. As it turns out, it's what did happen. Because we know now that, yes, all these contacts happen. Yes, they're very damaging to the Trump campaign. And Russia had them in its possession. So they've effectively had leverage over Trump from the start. Like, if they wanted to blackmail Trump, they could do it anytime they wanted to. Because there's definitely more emails out there. They're not been released yet. And Trump doesn't want them out there. Then on October, what was it? The 7th. That's when we get the Access Hollywood tape. Grab him by the pussy.
But it's fake. Didn't you hear that? It didn't really happen.
My God, yeah. He's now claiming it's fake. But like also that implies, assuming like he really is trying to say that, it means that he wasn't sure it was fake at the time. It's like, I don't recall saying that, but it's totally believable I did. Only after thinking about it for a while, he's like, wait, this one in particular isn't real. I mean, I could have said that, but I don't think I did this time.
And somebody should talk to Billy Bush, who was there, you know, and also apologized for laughing along.
And lost his job. What's interesting though, is that, earlier in October, we had known that WikiLeaks had more emails to release. They had like a press conference that was a big nothing, and they pushed it off and pushed it off and said, you know what, it'll be later. An hour after the Access Hollywood tape, not even an hour, like 30 minutes after Access Hollywood came out, WikiLeaks releases the Podesta emails, which I don't think is coincidence. I think there's clearly some kind of intentional diversion there. What I want to know was the initial delay in WikiLeaks release, was that because I knew the Access Hollywood tape was coming up and they wanted to save it as a distraction for when it did break.
Yeah, I don't know. What I find more plausible is that WikiLeaks had this in their hip pocket ready to drop when they felt the time was right. And they thought about it for a half an hour and they decided the time was right.
The time was not like, this is going to be the best thing we're going to distract from. Let's go ahead and launch.
Yeah. But by the way, I to this day, what was the incredibly incriminating thing in the Podesta emails that was so awful?
Spirit cooking.
Ah, okay. I don't
it's
understand.
It's some
that
kind
either.
Of cannibalism theory.
Ah, okay. Oh, you're talking about that they were having the coded conversations about Pizzagate.
No, it was a different one. They also were cannibals.
Oh, this is a different one? Oh, they're also cannibals. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
got
like,
it.
Spirit cooking. I haven't followed it close enough to know exactly what the base of the claim is. I just know that they were saying it.
And what always struck me as odd is that people always found something incredibly nefarious in the DNC supporting Hillary over Bernie in the primaries. You know, obviously, theoretically, it should be an even playing field. But you have Bernie, who only became a Democrat that year. And you have Hillary Clinton, who has spent, you know, four decades raising money and working the infrastructure of DNC and, in fact, building the DNC. Who do you think is going to have an advantage in that situation and have people on their side? I mean, it is ridiculous to expect that the DNC – and by the way, political parties can pick candidates any way they choose.
Right.
Also, the claims that like what they were trying to say was shown in the emails was never shown in the emails. It was always exaggerated. I mean, so there was stuff in there that was like, embarrassing or like not great. Like, for instance, one staffer wrote at one point, hey, maybe we should bring up the fact that Bernie is an atheist. I mean, he is a Jew, like, you know, so like that plays better in the South. Mm-hmm. But there's a big difference between being a Jew and an atheist. Like, if he's an atheist, that might hurt him. Mm-hmm. Which, again, it's dirty politics. Like, you're just our lack of religion. Conviction shouldn't be up for grabs. And it never was. It was just some staffer floating an idea. But what the email actually said, if it makes it better, I guess, is not that he wanted to portray him as Jewish, but they could consider portraying him as an atheist, and that would make a difference in Southern voters' minds. Mm. Of course, the way Trump and Trump Jr. and all them start like screaming about it, it's that they were trying to mock the fact that Bernie was Jewish, which was totally not the point of it.
Yeah, I think their outrage at all of this was kind of like, I mean, like, they really had so much love for Bernie. Just stop the bullshit. Come on.
Yes.
Yeah, like, there's an email between two Catholics on the Clinton staff that made a joke about being Catholic, which could be bad. But in context, having two people joke about their own religion.
That's okay.
Doesn't sound like a, yeah, that's, I'm not offended by that. I don't know if anyone really is. But the way they portrayed it sounded offensive. So again, there's so little in there that they had to sort of spin everything they did find to make it interesting. Of course, throughout this whole time period, Trump's going on about how great his relationship would be with Putin and how he doesn't think Russia really did all this, rah, rah, rah. I mean, the same bullshit lines he's giving now. Then we go into November. We have the Podesta emails released. This is not, when I say released, they're not releasing all of it on October 7th. They are having daily releases to try and keep it alive in the news cycle and try and have fresh outrage generated, new headlines every single morning about the Podesta email. So it was done in a way that wasn't designed to just give information out there. It was designed to be the most politically damaging way to Hillary possible.
Because every day you were anticipating, oh, they must have something worse tomorrow. Yeah, but every day,
surely there's something in here.
Yeah, they had nothing, you know, and it just kept this ongoing sense of dread for however many days they did it.
You know, I wasn't even paying. I didn't really pay attention to the Podesta emails because, like, they were so, none of them had anything interesting in it. I was like, well, something interesting was in there. We'll hear about it. But it never was. And I think that's kind of why that Trump got so frustrated and kept complaining that no one's looking at WikiLeaks. I mean, they were all looking at WikiLeaks and all talking about it all the time. But there really wasn't anything that great in there for them, other than the fact that they exist at all. Like, their existence is more important than the content. So, for my other podcast, Undisclosed, I often have to go out and interview lots of witnesses in Georgia or Baltimore or other cities where we're currently working cases. And oftentimes, I feel like more often than not, In between driving to houses, driving to interview locations, I end up not getting lunch. So to make it through the day, I have come to rely on Kind bars. If you know what they are, you may have seen them in the grocery store or at the coffee shop or gym. They are delicious, healthy snacks with whole ingredients you can recognize and pronounce. And my personal favorite is the apple cinnamon pecan, but they're all pretty great. And this holiday, you can treat everyone on your gift list to the Kind Cube. Now, the Kind Cube is filled with a variety of 20 tasty snack bars, and it makes a perfect gift for any snack lover, or for yourself, or me. They're made with delicious ingredients like nuts, fruits, and dark chocolate, and these bars are a gift that both your body and your taste buds will love to receive. So, for more information, don't forget to check out kindsnacks.com/4or5, and check it out to find a gift for everyone on your gift list this year. And then late October, Giuliani starts hinting that they've got an October surprise coming in. This is now being investigated because it seems to suggest that he knew in advance about the Comey letter, which very possible given the FBI and his relationships there in New York. And then it hits. October 28th, the Comey letter goes to Congress, and Chaffetz immediately releases it because that's who he is. Everyone's like, oh my God, this bizarre email scandal's up again. And like the New York Times has a whole page, the whole first page is dedicated to this. Even though the whole thing is like, there may be more emails, we haven't checked them out yet. We don't know what's going to be. Like, okay, that's like a pre-story right there. And to make things worse, the New York Times on October 31st runs an article that says, investigating Donald Trump, FBI sees no leak to Russia. Which I'm still angry about. Always will be, because that, one, it was wrong. It was all bullshit. And it was timed in such a way as to sort of like end any discussion of these obvious ties between Trump and Russia right before an election. And the way they handled the Hillary emails, which was not a story, versus an actual huge, gigantic, world-changing story, is shocking to me. And they've never, ever, New York Times has never explained this article. Like, it was wrong. They were lied to by the FBI, and they've never addressed that.
Yes, there's all kind of theories floating around that it was the Giuliani section of the FBI in New York as opposed to the Washington field office. Obviously, Washington is the headquarters of the FBI. But the idea is that some group in the loyal section to Giuliani had something to do with getting this story out.
That's just crappy journalism, then. Wouldn't they like ask for... I mean, any journalist worth their salt would ask for a comment, I mean, to verify that from Comey's office.
Agreed.
They did. But they didn't get a comment back. So let's say this happened, obviously. When you find out you're wrong, shouldn't you explain why you were wrong? Like, I feel like the New York Times never even tried to address what they did here, which was to cripple any legitimate questioning of Trump's Russia connections. And again, we know now that there was a huge investigation ongoing and it found many contacts between Russia and Trump. And there was a lot of alarm among like not just our intelligence community, but also foreign intelligence communities who were seeing what we were also seeing. But it happened. And if you read the analysis from 538 on it, it does seem like that was probably a decisive factor in the election. Absent the Comey letter, we would not have President Trump. But it's also worth keeping in mind, if we did have President Clinton, I think that the world would be seriously in trouble still, because what Russia did do, probably better than anything, even more so than its help for Trump, was sabotaging a Clinton presidency. They made it so they could have a Clinton scandal every single day from here until forever, and cripple her presidency before it began. You have guys like Chaffetz who quit Congress after Trump won because their whole goal for being there apparently was to like investigate Hillary Clinton scandals. And without that taken away from them, they're like, oh, it's no fun anymore.
Well, also, they've managed to just do huge damage to the integrity of the system and the perception of integrity in the system. You know, they've managed to clearly undermine the idea of the mainstream media for an enormous amount of people. They've managed to, you know, people are questioning whether the vote itself was hacked. They're, you know, and basically there's a free-floating anxiety of, you know, that is our government working, functioning
in
any
way? And it's I don't know how you fix that. It's bad. And yeah, Russia was there trying to stir up trouble, but this wouldn't have happened if there wasn't already some deep divisions existing in American culture. And I don't know if we'll ever separate what was sort of organic and what was nudged into high gear by Russian activities. I'd like to think that it was mostly organic, because I don't want to believe that a social media campaign could be that powerful, but I don't know that we can conclude it wasn't either. And again, Russia was hacking, like, the voter rolls. Was that just because they wanted to cause distrust? Like, they didn't actually do anything? Were they just hacking so that they could cite the hacks as, like, reason to distrust our democracy? Or were they actually doing something, like changing voter rolls to, like, kick off part of the population?
Why would they not? Why would they not do that?
I mean, because if you get caught doing that, it's a big deal. I mean, if you just hack in and do nothing, you can use that as evidence to say, look, the election was hacked. Without the
risk. It's kind of a big deal anyway. And I feel like that ship sailed. So, I mean, like, Russia does not give a crap. I mean, if they're caught.
They care. They don't want to. I mean, if it could be proven that they actually changed the actual voter roll, like the actual election results, I think we'd see a very different reaction. A social media campaign is bad, like what they were doing, but it's also not.
From
it's
who?
The same level.
I mean, honestly, I feel like the Trump base wouldn't care.
They didn't think Trump was going to win necessarily. Like, they couldn't be confident. If Clinton had won and they'd done that, that would be a big deal for them.
No, but I guess my question is, like, where would those repercussions come from? I feel like the GOP doesn't care. Look at what's happening with Roy Moore. I feel like the base doesn't care. I feel like.
But Clinton would be president and she would have more power to actually, even if Congress was not on board. And also, with Trump out of the picture, I bet a lot of the GOP would give a shit that Russia had actually hacked our, like, voter totals. Maybe. I'm being optimistic here.
I don't even know anymore.
You're very sweet, Susan. Very, very sweet.
But in case Russia's goals were in doubt, the message that WikiLeaks sent to John Jr. on the day of the election kind of gives it away. He wrote, "Hi, Don. If your father loses," and scare quotes, "we think it is much more interesting if he does not concede and spends time challenging the media and other types of rigging that occurred, as he has implied he might do. He is also much more likely to keep his base alive and energized this way, and if he is going to start a new network, showing how corrupt the old ones are is helpful. The discussion about the rigging can be transformative as it exposes media corruption, primary corruption, PAC corruption, etc."
Well, gosh, that would be interesting, Julian.
It would be much more interesting. Let's do it for that. And I'm sure he would have. If he had lost, he would have. I mean, it's possible that it would have been long term as much damage as his actual presidency is doing if he'd been able to actually undermine faith in democracy. But, you know, that didn't happen. Somehow he eked out the narrowest of wins. And I think what happened next is really instructive for, like, showing us for sure, like, Russia is out purely to hurt the U.S. They are not here to help Trump. They are just here for their own goals. Because the day after his win, the Russia social media campaign, the ads they're paying for, start kicking into anti-Trump ads. On November 9th, they paid for an ad that had, like, Trump's face crossed out and said, "Not my president." November 12 p.m., Union Square, New York City, come for a protest. It says...
It looks like it's done by Black Lives Matter.
Well, it's a knockoff Black Lives Matter.
Right. It's about causing chaos, basically.
And now Trump as president is better than just the chaos because it does have, or they hoped it had, policy implications for them they liked, mostly like sanctions going away. And it has. Like, Trump has not implemented the sanctions that were passed recently. But they still want to cripple his presidency. The day after he won, the deputy foreign minister made a statement, and he said there were contacts between Trump and Russia. And he says that they maintained contact with members of Trump's immediate entourage, that's a quote, during the campaign. And of course, immediately, Hope Hicks comes out with a statement saying it's all false. She says, "We are not aware of any campaign representatives that were in touch with any foreign entities before yesterday when Mr. Trump spoke with..." Oh, Hope Hicks.
Sorry.
And she says on the 11th, in response to the comments from the deputy foreign minister, "It never happened. There was no communication between the campaign and any foreign entity during the campaign." And that's where we end off. And again, this is a very highly, highly abbreviated discussion. Hopefully, if you go look at the chart, there's much more shown there. But the basic evolution of all of this, I mean, first of all, okay, the idea that there was no collusion, like, I think that's gone. But it's also... striking in that you can see how we've gone from on November 11th that the campaign could outright state there were no connections whatsoever and, like, be offended at the idea there were connections to where we are now a year later and, like, there are dozens of connections firmly established, but the conversation hasn't shifted that much. Like, And I guess it's the slow boil theory. Like, they could kind of trot out all these contacts one by one. And even though we have a tsunami of them now, people aren't reacting like there is.
Because we've been habituated to the idea. But and also you have people sort of you have like the Alan Dershowitzes saying going past that and saying, yeah, but so what? It's not technically illegal. You know, it went from it never happened to, well, but it's not technically illegal.
Yeah. But also like coordinating with someone who stole property to use that property to your advantage. It's a crime.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
And I think that the policy promises are going to be one of the more damning aspects of this, because it does seem like there were promises to change policy when they came into power in exchange for receiving goodies from Russia. And again, there's no time to cover all this here, but another interesting side thread here is tracking like what was leaked when and who was leaking it, because there was a lot of confusion this whole time. I mean, even now people will talk about how Hillary's emails from when she was at State Department were leaked, and they weren't. They've never come out. We don't know if they exist. But there's so many different kind of hackings that occur, how many leaks that occurred, that the conversations get muddled together, and it's harder to track who's talking about what and who's involved where. With Roger Stone especially, this confusion kind of matters, because he talks about leaks that never even happened in the first place. For a while, he talked about, for instance, the Clinton Foundation leaks, which there weren't any. So I'd be very curious to learn why he thought they were going to happen, who told him they were, and is it possible he muddied the message in his own head?
That's possible. But I also think that there's probably at least one person on Mueller's team who's creating that chart.
Oh, yeah. They know exactly what – they've got all that figured out. And I wish we had more stories on the actual leaks that happened, just to keep them separate and to explore motivations there. But, yeah, that's where we are. So, yes or no, was there collusion? What do y'all think?
I'm going to go with yes. It's not cautious. But more important, I mean, is the constant stream of lies, the constant stream of denials. I would just hope people would come away from this understanding that the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks and Roger Stone and all these people have no compunction about being incredibly dishonest all the time. You know, a lot of people, I think people still have, you know, a somewhat romanticized idea about WikiLeaks. Some people, not many. But it has been an expressly anti-American organization from its inception. And they've been absolutely willing to be completely dishonest in that mission.
Wasn't WikiLeaks like the darling of the radical left at one point?
It was for a while.
Yeah.
How is it still?
Well,
it's the Greenwald version of like there's no reality that matters and the whole Russia thing is bogus sort of theory.
Yeah. Until you have somebody putting out your shit, you're thrilled with the transparency, you know. But then once they hack you, you go, oh, wait a minute. You know, I mean, in this chart, you have one of WikiLeaks' tweets in October of 2016 on Halloween saying, no link between Trump and Russia, no link between Assange and Russia, but Podesta and Clinton involved in selling 20% of U.S. uranium to Russia. Now, of course, all three of those things are just lies. In every respect, they only when you go, OK, I understand now WikiLeaks, part of their mission, their radical transparency is for one purpose, which is to undermine the United States government for whatever reasons Julian Assange has. As long as you understand that's their goal, then proceed with your WikiLeaks adoration, knowing that.
And what it also shows is that it's not just a matter of like what the content matters of the emails, not like how they're released. It's the existence of them, period, that caused problems. Like most of the emails and there's the Hillary had that were leaked and the DNC and Podesta weren't bad politically. They weren't like some political, like nothing that was truly scandalous in there. But that didn't stop it from being a recurring headline every single day. It didn't stop it from being like the major issue that Hillary was judged by. And if that kind of situation, you can't just be perfect and like say like, oh, I'm never going to be bad, so it doesn't matter if I get leaked or hacked. It doesn't matter. You can be perfect in every respect in terms of ethics and how you're performing. But if your emails are leaked, they can be used in a way that's politically crippling.
But I feel like, you know, the weight of that, the guilt of that lies really on the media that made that news over and over and over. It was not news. And they kept making it news. And then, of course, Comey did his terrible part in it, which how do you feel about him now, by the way? I know. Didn't we talk about this earlier? And you said, well, I'm still angry at him.
I'm not angry. I've always like Comey. I don't think he's not like a bad guy here. I think his goal to like preserve the purity of the FBI, I think sometimes took the front seat when really the overall good of the United States should have taken the front seat. But he was so committed to like the process that, and like his own organization's purity, that he took steps that I think were ultimately damaging to the U.S. Like, he didn't want to risk, for instance, what it looks like is he did not want to risk the perception that the DOJ was like corrupt by not taking any action against Hillary and not having any statement on her, and then having this email get leaked and show that, oh, look, the DOJ was always in the bag for her. I think he was concerned with avoiding that outcome, and he thought that by doing what he did, he could sort of neutralize the effect that email might have.
Poorly calculated, basically.
Yeah, basically. I think he prioritized things that shouldn't have been prioritized. But I don't think he was ever like trying to hurt Hillary or trying to hurt Trump. I think he was neutral in that respect. I just don't agree with what he did try and preserve.
Well, I think we're all operating in a different environment than we realized. I mean, I think everybody's still cleaving to the old rules to some respect. I mean, we're operating in a completely polluted information environment that does not, where the old rules just don't apply anymore. And I think he was operating in that environment and trying to retain the perception of objectivity at the FBI, but could not have foreseen how all this would get spun.
Like, he could have chosen to not announce the existence of the server, the Wiener server. And then then possibly, yes, there's a good chance that maybe he would have gotten like crucified for it later. They'd say like, oh, you were so like biased trying to help Hillary. You didn't even disclose the existence of an unimportant server with no new emails on it. So to avoid that outcome, he took a different one with even worse effects. But again, this is all, there's no clear causation here. But I don't think that matters necessarily. What we know happened is enough to show the risk is real. The damage is obviously real. And the fact that Trump is clearly not trying to stop this kind of thing from happening again means our democracy is in dire straits. And I don't want to be alarmist, but how else can you describe it when you have a president that got into power after being helped by a foreign power who was actively encouraging that foreign power to do it again?
So perhaps we need another episode of the 45th of what we can do, because there are a lot of processes. I think we've got to work on voter integrity in terms of, you know, go to paper ballots everywhere.
Yes.
We have to initiate some sort of a nationwide, this idea was floated on Twitter, of a Manhattan Project to secure the United States computers from cyber attack. I know that sounds like a crazy dream given the system the way it is, but you know, somebody's got to start making that effort. Do you guys have any ideas that could change things?
I think that's the demoralizing part, because any kind of action in that respect, I mean, there are important things being done at the state level and like in media, but you need the federal government behind that, and they're not right now, and they have a very strong self-interested reason to not be behind it.
We haven't really talked about culpability in terms of like social media platforms. Getting Twitter and Facebook and other platforms that are helping to spread a lot of the disinformation and, I mean, like, you know, fake news and all that, like that had a big impact too. And all these things kind of have to work together. That's the hard thing to think about, is like, how do you get, okay, let's say you get state by state, you know, county by county, get them to put paper ballots, but then you have to think about cybersecurity, but then you have to think about social media. There's just so many different things at play right now. I don't think it's not doable. I think it will take a very long time to recover from this though.
Yeah. Want to hear my other conspiracy theory about Facebook ads? I say this with a tongue in cheek, but remember how Zuckerberg was doing his little Iowa and New Hampshire tour in 2017?
Oh, that was hilarious.
Yeah. But like, why? What happened to make Zuckerberg think that, you know what, I could be president? Well, maybe if he saw what the Facebook ads were really doing, he was like, well, shit, I can use that in my favor and be president. Of course, now I think with all the fallout, that's luckily gone by the wayside. But I do wonder what happened exactly in Zuckerberg's head to make him think now I can be president, too.
Yeah, I don't think that's conspiracy level. I think that's a really good question, actually.
It was an odd pivot, I have to say. That was not what I expected from him.
Maybe he just really wanted to go to Iowa.
Yeah. There's some great county fair food. There is, actually. It makes sense. You know, a billionaire, although he is much more likely a billionaire than Donald Trump.
Real billionaire.
But, you know, a real billionaire who, you know, has more of an interaction with humanity I would say, than Donald Trump, just won the presidency, basically, you know, considering that, you know, this guy with no grasp of the truth or honesty or policies or any real understanding of how the federal government work just won, you know, who's to say Zuckerberg doesn't have a chance at that
All
point?
I can say is I'm glad that Kid Rock was not really running for Senate.
Yes.
Oh, I really thought it was for real because and then we had Siraj on, who was like, yeah, I think he'll win. And the thing is, I actually think he might have won, too. That was a relief.
Yeah.
So, Susan, you created this incredible chart using a tool called lucidchart.com. Are we going to make that available to our listeners?
Yes, I'll post it somewhere.
Okay,
it's excellent. So impressive. It's spectacular, folks. It is spectacular and damning and occasionally entertaining.
I tried to keep the commentary to a minority, but.
Well, you know, there's a part of me that wants to print it out and put it like all over one bare wall and then just use like yarn yeah. to like create
a
one of those
Criminal Minds or something.
It's screaming out for that. Well, anyway. Well, thank you guys both so much. Susan, thanks for this deep dive. And of course, I'm sure you're going to keep us updated on anything else that comes out. And hopefully maybe you can keep adding to the chart, right?
Yeah.
Also for people to find out what's going on. And John, thank you so much for your time, your precious time away from Undisclosed.
Well, thank you guys for inviting me. It was such a pleasure. And again, seeing this in its totality is kind of awe-inspiring. And thank you, Susan. Obviously, you put an enormous amount of work into this. And it's troubling and horrifying and necessary. So thank you.
And we'd love to have you back, John, to talk about, like, you know, a general news week, which is also batshit crazy.
Yeah. Just make fun of like Bannon and Conway the whole time.
Yeah, sure. I love it. I'll be back anytime.
Great. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks,
all right,
John. Thanks,
listeners,
John.
We will see you guys next week then. Big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345, and you never know. We might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.
My earbud, I gotta get a better headset because my earbud strings are toys to them, apparently.
Ooh, AirPods.
Yeah, so I can't AirPods. Swipe at them.
I don't trust those things.
Yeah.
What do you think they're gonna do to you?
I don't know. I don't want like a wireless signal coming to my head. I'm saying that as I'm talking to my smartphone. I don't know why. Just don't ask. I don't do the Bluetooth. It's just weird to me. Anyhow, I got those big fat, you know, like those DJ style headphones. They're so comfy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But anyway.
Sorry
to distract.